This is The Source on Texas Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. In 1973, Gladys Knight and the Pips released Use My Imagination. With their classic tight arrangement, stylized performance, and incredible vocals, it's reasonable to think that this is another recounting of Love Gone Wrong. But is there more here? Was Knight singing a coded message, lamenting about racial injustice, and urging listeners who could crack the code to keep on keeping on? Emily J. Lordy explores that in her book, The Meaning of Soul, Black Music and Resilience Since the 1960s.
Well, it becomes really hard to define it because it is a slippery term and it's a highly contested term. In the 1960s, as I explain in my book, it becomes not only the word for a genre of music, which itself encompasses a lot of different kinds of styles, blues, R&B, more kind of gospel-focused idioms, but it also becomes a term for Black identity. And this idea of having soul becomes a kind of organizing principle around which people, Black people, start to kind of gather and organize. And so it's supposed to be a capacious category, actually. And so what I try to do is not so much to rigidly define it as to explain what I think it meant to people in this particular moment, both as a musical concept, but also as a more general kind of principle of living and organizing and trying to move through the world at this particular point.
Is there a song that really defines a breakout soul moment?
I mean, there are several different moments. I guess I could begin by saying that I think soul has generally been understood through songs like kind of movement anthem songs, such as Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come would be a good example of that, or Nina Simone's Young, Gifted, and Black, or a little later, a more kind of Black power themed song like James Brown's Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. And those are all excellent examples of soul songs. But I think that they tend, if we focus only on those kinds of explicitly pro-Black anthems or songs of protest, then we can miss some other songs that are soul songs and that are doing this important kind of work of inspiring and encouraging Black people, but that are not so explicit in terms of the lyrics. So one good example of a song that I think does this inspiring, motivating work, but isn't, you know, so obviously kind of a protest song or an identity song per se, is Aretha Franklin's performance of Amazing Grace, which she performs on the gospel album of that name at a church in Watts in the early 1970s. First of all, there's this incredibly dramatic build that she has, being Aretha. You know, she has this incredible ability to kind of build the narrative of a song. And so she really takes her time, as the church folk might say, in you know, gearing up and just revving up and finally delivering these climactic notes, you know, on the words Amazing Grace. But she changes the lyrics as well. And by the end of the song, she's saying, I know it's going to be that grace that's going to lead me and my people home. So whereas in the original song, the words are that grace will lead me home, right? It's a kind of individual redemption. Here, Aretha makes it a much more collective enterprise. And that to me really signifies kind of what soul is trying to do.
Aretha Franklin never really seems to get the credit that she deserves for being a songwriter and an arranger. And,
yeah.
And you see that with like the song Respect. It was written originally by Otis Redding. And then she took the song and totally just reimagined it.
She certainly did. And that moment really speaks to her genius as an arranger, as you say, as a producer, as somebody who was able to hear not only somebody who recognized a great song when she heard it, but somebody who could hear the latent potential in that song and could hear not only what it was, but also what it could be. And so what she does with that song, one thing that she does with it, of course, is she breaks down the title and does something that Otis Redding doesn't do, which is she sings R-E-S-P-E-C-T, right? And as she later said, she said, you know, I thought I should spell it out. I thought people might not understand really what the force of the respect I was asking for if I didn't literally break it down for them. The other thing that she does is she brings in her backup singers. And so that too makes this call for respect a more kind of collective enterprise, makes it a collective anthem, a Black women's anthem, as well as an anthem for Black people more broadly, for women, you know, across color lines. And it's really doing quite a bit of work socially, culturally, and musically, in terms of just announcing Aretha as a genius and somebody who is not afraid to take a great song by the King of Soul himself and remake it in her own image and show that she had arrived.
Write that covering other people's music and then reinventing it for your own voice and your own space is a hallmark of soul music. We did see it also with Otis Redding when he did Try a Little Tenderness, which Aretha Franklin had covered the year before.
You know, I like this kind of dance, this play between Aretha and Otis, where, you know, Aretha does a song that he's done and he does a song that she has done. But he really capitalized on Try a Little Tenderness. And it's something that I say about that particular moment in my book is that when Otis Redding covers Try a Little Tenderness, he completely refashions the song. He speeds it up. He makes it this incredible tour de force of just bombastic, powerful Otis Redding style charisma. And he also, I think, changes the social meaning. In so doing, I think he changes the meaning that we can draw from the song if we're thinking about it in a certain way. And what I mean by that is that, you know, on the face of it, Otis Redding singing Try a Little Tenderness, you know, in this really aggressive way, seems ironic, right? He's telling somebody to try being tender, but he's not singing in a particularly tender way, you know, as the original people who recorded the song would have done.
It was first recorded in 1933.
Yeah, so it was a crooner's type of ballad. And when Otis does it, you know, in his own real, you know, kind of barnstorming, bring the house down kind of way. What I hear in that is him saying, you know, I hear it as an appeal to white America, saying, for God's sake, try a little tenderness. Oh, she may be willing. The young girls, they do get weary, wearing that same old shaggy dress. Yeah. But when she gets weary, try a little tenderness. Yeah. Oh, man, nah. I know she's waiting. So when he sings about the girl waiting, you know, just anticipating the thing that she'll never possess, while she's there waiting, try a little tenderness. I hear that as this idea of, you know, some people who would have preached a gradualist approach to civil rights, and saying, just wait a little longer, you know, don't disturb the peace, quote unquote. For me, it's him saying, like, we've been waiting, we're done waiting. You know, what are you going to do? How are you going to kind of comport yourselves, and what are you going to try? And he's suggesting in this, again, kind of ironically, very, very powerful way, that people on the other side try a little tenderness. So I don't think that he necessarily intended it as a social allegory, but I do think that this way of reading soul and the multiple meanings of soul gets opened up if we start trying to hear it on what Ralph Ellison might have called the lower frequencies, in addition to the higher or more obvious ones. Another such practice is the use of soul artists' use of their falsetto registers, which in and of itself is another kind of aspirational kind of musical move, right? So when somebody like Al Green or Isaac Hayes, or even I include here Minnie Riperton, use this very high vocal register, that in and of itself suggests a kind of striving, a kind of aspiration. And even if, again, that song that they're singing is not about the movement, you know, is not about You Are Young, Gifted, and Black, is not about Mississippi Goddamn, that very sound of striving and hope and going where you really didn't think you could go and where nobody thought you could go, or very few people might have thought you could go, that insistence on going there is itself a kind of soul practice. One of my favorite songs that would demonstrate this, that would showcase this, is Al Green's recording of Summertime. But the other thing to point out about Al Green's recording of that song, it's not just his use of falsetto and his soaring, you know, enactment of that idea of taking to the sky, right? You spread your wings, are the lyrics, and take to the sky. But it's also that he uses the we. One of these mornings, we're going to rise up singing. So again, like Aretha's Amazing Grace, you know, where that grace is going to lead me and my people right on home. For Al Green, it's not just about that individual aspiring to something better for himself. It's about we are going to rise up and kind of do this thing together. Rise up.
sing, yeah. Take to the sky. Yeah. Woo! Nothing. Nowhere. Oh, no.
The falsetto is interesting, but I also wonder about the growly, gravelly voice that we hear sometimes, maybe from someone like James Brown, and please, 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 an outbursty sort of exuberant, lustful singing voice.
You know, the idea that the strain is actually something that is valued in this particular kind of aesthetic, non-Western aesthetic system, you know, where the classical Western music might say, you know, you want to perform your singing as if it weren't emitted from an actual body, right? That the clearer the vocal tone, the better. This is a different musical vocal tradition, one largely rooted in the Black church and in Black preaching styles, you know, that says the body is the source, right? That as a scholar, Farrah Jasmine Griffin writes in an essay, you don't get transcendence except through the body and through bodily effort and bodily labor. And so a lot of these singers do absolutely insist on the body that the voice is coming from, and that gravelly, groaning sound is a big part of that.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. We're talking about the meaning of soul with author Emily J. Lordy. Let's go to break listening to James Brown and Please, Please, Please. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're discussing the book, The Meaning of Soul, Black Music and Resilience Since the 1960s, with author Emily J. Lordy. This is Marina Shaw and California Soul.
Marina Shaw is, she's an extraordinary talent and somebody who deserves even greater recognition than she has received. A song that I've thought about is her song, Woman of the Ghetto, which is more kind of political anthem, certainly, than California Soul, but that also showcases her incredible inventiveness. So, you know, the message itself is very important, that she's singing as, in the persona of the woman from the ghetto, the woman of the ghetto, right? In this very powerful, charismatic voice. So as opposed to, you know, a lot of reports that were coming out on the part of white sociologists saying, like, what's happening in the Black ghetto, right? She's saying, well, here's what's happening. I will speak in my own voice as a subject as opposed to an object of somebody else's analysis and scrutiny.
I was born, raised in a ghetto. I was born ghetto. I'm a woman of the ghetto. Won't you listen, won't you listen, won't you listen to me then just later.
How do you raise? But the message aside, the vocal inventiveness that she performs through the scatting that she does, and just all the different ways that she's playing with the melody and the harmony there, show, you know, her accomplishments as somebody who could sing jazz as well as sing soul and sing all different kinds of forms. And so that versatility is something that's remarkable about her. And it speaks, as again, to just the diversity within soul as a rubric.
Stop.
us more about Minnie Riperton?
Minnie Riperton was an extraordinary vocal artist who grew up in Chicago. She studied classical voice, and she sang at Chess Records. She started out as a kind of backing vocalist and with a girl group called The Gems, and then she moved on to sing with a group called Rotary Connection, which was a great kind of psychedelic chamber soul experimental band, interracial, really pushing some musical boundaries, recording with the fantastic producer and arranger Charles Stepney. And from there, she goes on to do some solo work that really, again, not unlike an Al Green or an Isaac Hayes, is expanding the sound of soul and is saying that soul can be these lush orchestrations, you know, these different kinds of arrangements, and it can involve this incredible coloratura soprano sound that one would associate more with opera.
The reasons for my life all in a million faces, like aching promises, I feel them in my bones.
Minnie Riperton is the first kind of person to really put the whistle register on the map in terms of popular music. You know, we later hear this in the work of Mariah Carey, but Minnie Riperton was the first one to do it. And, you know, again, that's that sound of aspiration. She was an interesting artist because she said, you know, I don't necessarily want to sing the blues, you know, just because I'm a Black woman, you know, doesn't mean I want to sing the blues. I'm a very happy person. And so she has this kind of like spirited joy in this bohemian aesthetic that she brings to the soul tradition. But I still hear in her music this sound of struggle and overcoming. And I hear it in part just through whatever she's singing about. And some of her songs are more, you know, explicitly political. But even if they're not, that move up into the upper echelons, you know, the stratosphere of vocal achievement is to me the sound of soul.
This is The Source. I'm David Martin Davies, speaking with Emily J. Lordy about her book, The Meaning of Soul. Let's go to break with Minnie Riperton's 1975 smash crossover hit, Loving You.
Making love with you is all I wanna do. Loving you is more than just a dream come true.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about the book, The Meaning of Soul, with its author, Emily J. Lordy. In addition to soul music, there is also poetry that reflects soul. Let's listen to Lucille Clifton.
My daddy has paid the rent, and the insurance man is gone, and the lights is back on, and my uncle Brud has hit for $1 straight. And they is good times, good times, good times. My mama has made bread, and grandpa has come, and everybody is drunk and dancing in the kitchen and singing in the kitchen. Oh, these is good times, good times, good times. Oh, children, think about the good times.
Lucille Clifton is a poet who sort of comes of age around the time that many of my soul singers do. You know, her first collection is Good Times, and it's interesting, actually, because, you know, she's talking about the good times that she experiences, you know, being the young Black girl growing up. And it's a counter narrative to the dominant narrative that is out, you know, in terms of a mainstream, largely white national discourse about, you know, the tragedy of Black life and, you know, what is broken and, you know, what is deficient. Lucille Clifton, you know, she has a poem that's called In the Inner City. And she, you know, says in the inner city, or like we call it, home, suggesting, you know, right off the bat that you know, this is an insider's view of a space that often gets kind of marked, if not demonized, from the outside. And so she was about, you know, an inside chronicling of African-American life and creativity and spirituality, and perhaps her most obviously soulful poetic contribution or performance is a song called Won't You Sell It, or rather a poem, which I think is untitled, but it's known by the words, Won't You Celebrate With Me? And the final lines of that are, Won't you celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and has failed? And in performance, actually, when she read the poem, I keep calling it a song and kind of slipping between the two, but that's probably appropriate. She would often change that pronoun to every day something has tried to kill us and has failed. And so inviting listeners, in the audience to understand themselves as part of that resilient we that she was invoking. And that is a very soul gesture, not just the we, but that idea of like every day something is trying to kill us and has failed and we'll keep failing, you know, as long as we kind of try to stick this thing out together.
Won't you celebrate with me what I have shaped into a kind of life? I had no model. Born in Babylon, both non-white and woman, what did I see to be except myself? I made it up here on this bridge between starshine and clay, my one hand holding tight my other hand. Come, celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and has failed.
It seems life has played a game on me. I'm lost in a sea of misery. My love has turned as a back
When we think about music being part of the soul canon, does that help us give us a framework? Now we're putting a frame around songs or poems or other artistic expression and saying, we want you to look at it through this lens as an expression of life in Black America, dealing with certain issues that are very relevant today, particularly with the Black Lives Matter movement, and saying, okay, this is now soul.
Well, for me, I guess the concept of the framework of soul, what it gives us is a way of saying it's an invitation to read certain artistic productions, as ways of expressing this idea of Black resilience through the medium of creativity. So, and through, you know, the medium of this kind of we, this idea of the we. So that could be a lot of different things, but, you know, if you say, you know, this is a soul poem because it expresses resilience through the concept of creativity, then I think that does often give you a different lens on it. And it gives a different lens on Black creativity, you know, which is sometimes seen as the expression of what is so hard, what is difficult, you know, this speaking truth to power in terms of pain and suffering and oppression. And of course, that's been crucial, but it's also, Black culture workers will tell you this. It's just as important to talk about Black love, Black joy, and this idea of collective resilience, this sense of overcoming again and again against all the odds.
I hear something saying, ah, 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 ah. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they're saying, ooh.
As a protest music, if it's a protest music, even if it's not actually protesting anything, sometimes my presence is a protest. Part of that is you have to have an elite that is challenged by your presence and what you are saying and what you're trying to accomplish. Did soul music, did it challenge a popular idea or an establishment?
My work is so hard, give me water. I'm thirsty, my work is so hard, oh, my.
I think that it's useful to think about it in the terms that you just described, in terms of the insistence on Black presence, Black genius, Black brilliance, Black survival, and collective survival, again, not just the singular individual here and there, the exceptional person who happened to make it. but that is always a protest, you know, that is always a challenge to the dominant culture. There's a scholar named Patricia Williams who says, you know, even a couple Black people gathering together can, you know, for a very fearful and guilty American public sometimes can look like a riot, can look like a threat. So Soul's claim to a collective, broad-based Black encouragement, movement, and presence and power, absolutely, I think, was a kind of challenge to dominant ideals in the white supremacist system through and through.
And still, there was a commercial appeal. It did cross over. There were white consumers. White people watched Soul Train too.
Right. That's absolutely right. There's an undeniable mass appeal to Soul. And so what we get from that, I think, is, you know, when we talk about the reception of this, it's complicated. You know, there's no way to know who is getting what exactly out of it, right? And how? And if I were a sociologist or an ethnographer, I might have actually, you know, looked more at different kinds of statistics or different kinds of evidence to ask some of those questions. But I do think that that's something that's beautiful about popular culture, is you never really know who it's touching and how. But, you know, I think what I wanted to suggest is just that, you know, it had a certain meaning. That Soul Train and some of these other performances, at their best, had a certain kind of empowering impact on Black audiences in particular. And again, that these songs and the shows could have had that impact, even if they weren't explicitly, you know, say it loud, I'm Black and I'm proud, or you are young, gifted, and Black. It was the presence and the creativity that was itself quite stirring in many cases.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Meaning of Soul is the book. The author is Emily J. Lordy. I'm David Martin Davies, and this is Donnie Hathaway bringing us to break, singing in 1973, Someday We'll All Be Free.
Keep your self-respect, your man.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, and I'm with Emily J. Gordon talking about her book, The Meaning of Soul.
Sometimes in our lives, we all have pain, we all have sorrow, but if we are wise, we know that tomorrow. Lean on me when you're not strong, and I'll be your friend. I'll help you carry on.
So today, as we see what some people are calling a new civil rights movement, hopefully we've yet to see what happens. You go to some of these protest, or you watch them on video, and people start breaking out into some of these songs.
Are they old? Are they like old movement anthems, or are they like?
No, they're old, like Motown mm-hmm. songs or soul songs, and.
Happy to hear that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Songs in political protest are extremely important. It provides an opportunity for everyone to act in union. It provides script sharing about what it is that we're trying to accomplish. And then being able to dip into something that is historically shared by all of these individuals and to say, we come from different places, but we all know these songs and it's important to us. And they're particularly important to me right now.
That is a legacy of the soul era for sure, is that idea that song could be a rallying cry, right? It wasn't just about entertainment. It wasn't just for dancing, but it was for, you know, as Martha and the Vandellas said, it's for dancing in the street. And whether or not they meant that as a radical protest anthem that was meant to incite people to riots and rebellions, you know, that's how it was taken up. And so my colleague Shauna Redman writes about this, you know, the idea of the anthem as being such a powerful force of moving people, bringing them together around and through the medium of song. And that is certainly a soul legacy, and it does continue today.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we some loving here today. Hey, Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love.
Marvin Gaye's song, What's Going On, seems to be particularly resonant today.
Yes. Yes, it does. And in terms of soul legacies, you know, it's interesting that one of the artists that I write about, more contemporary artists that I write about in the book, is Janelle Monáe. And she has a song on her 2013 album, Electric Lady, where she says, I'm tired of Marvin asking me what's going on. And that is both an assertion of the continuing relevance of soul singers like Marvin Gaye.
Yeah, what's going on? What's going on? Tell me what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on.
And also a lament that they continue to be so relevant, right? And she doesn't want Marvin to be asking her what's going on anymore. She doesn't want to be hearing the same songs and thinking, oh, this is as relevant today as it was in 1970. But there's a kind of ambivalence, I think, about soul inheritances and soul legacies at the moment. But it is undeniable that these things stay with us.
Watch me! Watch me! I got it! Watch me! I got it! Hey! I got something that makes me want to shout. Something that tells me what it's all about. I got soul and I'm super bad. I got soul and I'm super bad. Now I got a move that tells me what to do. Sometimes it's easy. Now I got a move that tells me what to do. Sometimes I feel so nice, I want to try myself a few. I got soul.
You can never really predict who's going to get what from a song because there's so much there, right? You know, in terms of like contemporary popular music. But I think that that tradition of the double-voiced, what scholars might call the double-voiced utterance, is alive and well in the soul tradition, and that's why you can hear it on these different levels. So under slavery, you know, there's this idea of a song like Steal Away, right, which is a coded song planning to escape, right? That Steal Away to Jesus is the lyrical content, but it's also like, we're going to get the hell out of here, right? We are stealing away tonight, or, you know, whenever it's been determined. And, you know, these are the kinds of messages that the critic Paul Gilroy says are created under the nose of the overseer, right? This idea of smuggling illicit, illegal content through song, which seems like, oh, lovely, the slaves are singing, right? But as Frederick Douglass tells us, that it's never just singing. Every tone for him is a testimony, he says, against the anguish produced by slavery. And it just depends who's listening and how they're listening, what you're going to get from it. And so those multiple meanings continue, those coded meanings, the smuggling of the messages, you know, they continue through the soul tradition and even into the music today.
At last, my love has come along. My lonely days are over. Was wrapped up in clover. The night I looked at you, I found a dream that I could speak to, a dream that I can call. I found a thrill to press my cheek to, a thrill that I have never known. Oh yeah, yeah, you smile, oh, and then the spell was cast.
And the legacy today, there are samples of popular soul songs come forth again, and we see people presenting a neo soul and repackaging that as well. Where do you see the legacy of soul?
Well, you know, I see the legacy of soul in so many singers who are committed to a kind of virtuosic performance of innovation, and who undertake that with the view toward collective meaning, maybe not necessarily collective liberation or, you know, something that is quite so ambitious. I don't think it has to be that ambitious, in other words. But people who are collectively minded, creative individuals who are, you know, often influenced by the church. So somebody who comes to mind here is Brittany Howard, you know, who was the lead vocalist, guitar player for Alabama Shakes, and whose solo album came out, first solo album came out last year, you know, who's the church influence sounds through everything that she does. But she has certain moments on that album that sound like Curtis Mayfield songs, you know, and she is bringing the secular and sacred together, and all these different kinds of musical forms together in these extraordinary performances of Black brilliance. And so she's somebody who's very formal in this soul tradition.
Emily J. Lordy is the author of the book, The Meaning of Soul, Black Music and Resilience Since the 1960s. It's published by Duke University Press. We close with Brittany Howard and Stay High.
That you come from, yeah.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by Ruben Garcia and Kathleen Creedon. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.